soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow the rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. Think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. First you must learn how to smile when you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
Well, hello, everybody. This is Brooke Hines sitting in for Rick Spezak tonight on the Progressive News Network. Tonight we have a Florida Squeeze special. That's me and Rick and Kartik Krishnayer sitting in for an hour to talk about some issues national and state and local going on in Florida. And we are going to be talking a little bit about a little bit left of center, a little bit more to the left of the left of center, if you're at all familiar with our writing on the Florida Squeeze. Do check out the floridasqueeze.blogspot.com. I believe you can also get there just by the floridasqueeze.com. I've got Kartik queued up on the line, but real quick, I want to get, not get rid of, but I want to do some business for Rick and make sure that we have some of our bills getting paid. So right now, here are the Daughters of Isis.
Daughters of Isis is the ancestor of aromacology, indigenous scents representing the fragrant memories of our ancestors, to provide us the tools of the inner quest, the authentic moment, and to heal the Earth Mother. DaughtersofIsis.com. Wholesale available also. Mention PNN and enjoy a free sample from our apothecary. For your aromatherapy needs, that's daughtersofisis.com.
And we're back. And I also like to do, every time I get on the air, I like to mention all my disclaimers. I am a member of the Democratic Progressive Caucus of Florida, and I also work for the Alan Grayson for Senate campaign, as does Kardec, and we try to keep our noses as clean as possible as we talk about subjects around those two entities. And Kardec, are you there?
I am. How are you tonight, Brooke?
I am well. Get right up on your microphone, and I think we've got you coming in pretty good.
Okay, good.
Oh, there you are. So, you know, I thought we might start out tonight talking a little bit about the national scene, because, you know, we just went through two of our conventions, or our rebranding rituals, as I like to think of them. And we're kind of starting to see how this is playing out in the hinterlands. And we're starting to get poll numbers back, and we're starting to see how each of these conventions and each of these re-imaging and these revisioning projects are starting to play out. And so I wanted to see what your thoughts were, since we haven't had you on the air yet. I wanted to see what your thoughts were on just simply on the Democratic convention.
It was choreographed theater. All at once.
Kardec?
I mean, yes. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
We might have lost Kardec for a second. So, yes, he just fell off. He's going to call right back in. And if you heard that bing, that is Kardec texting me saying he'll call right back in. But I do want to get his thoughts. But I do want to get his thoughts also on the Democratic convention, because that's going to set up how we're going to discuss the rest of our national pieces. And there he is, back in our queue. And here we go. Hey there, Kardec. You back?
I am back. Can you hear me?
We got you live, Kardec?
Yeah, can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Hold on just a second.
Can you hear me now?
Okay.
You can hear us.
Let me play. Okay, so what I'm hearing is that the audience can hear him, and now I can't hear him. So that's interesting. And you can hear us both. This is my associate producer out in the living room telling me that everyone can hear us both, but I can't hear us both. That is interesting. Let's see. Do this. All right.
How about now?
Hard to come back in and
Can you hear me now? Give me some testing. Testing. 1, 2, 3. Can you hear me now?
All right. I still can't hear you. So I'm going to play another promo and try to fix this really quick. Hold on, folks.
Why are non-religious individuals and families joining Humanists of the Treasure Coast?
Thanks, Rick. People join Humanists of the Treasure Coast to meet other individuals and families who are leading ethical lives free of gods and religion. We educate the public about the positive values associated with humanism, promote the separation of church and state, and work to end discrimination against the non-religious. Humanists of the Treasure Coast is developing a humanist center that provides a supportive environment for humanists, atheists, and agnostics who are tired of feeling pressured to hide their secular outlook on life. To learn more about Humanists of the Treasure Coast, visit us on Facebook or online, or better yet, come to one of our humanist meetings in Jupiter, Stewart, and Vero Beach and join in our discussions.
Well, thanks, Joe, and thanks to the Humanists of the Treasure Coast.
And do we have Cardiff now?
You should. I'm here.
All right. I figured out what was going on. So we were talking about coming out of the conventions, and I wanted to get your, $5 tour of what you thought about the Democratic Convention before we went on into more national politics.
It was heavily staged. It was choreographed. It was great theater, done for a television audience. And I guess they did a good job of choreographing political convention. That's what political conventions are about now, right? For the television audience and the cable talking heads and all these shout shows to analyze. I'm not sure there was quite anything of note or substance or value that actually happened that week in Philadelphia. But I'm sure we can discuss that as the hour wears on.
Well, you know, it was interesting. I heard Glenn Beck losing his mind that he felt that the Democrats did such a better job of embracing patriotism and using, fear as a motivator. He felt that the Dems did a much better job of using these usual Republican tropes than the Republicans did.
Yeah, I thought they did very well in trying to identify the party as a quote mainstream party and a place where patriotism and a defense of American liberty would be sacrosanct. That seemed to be the theme of much of the Democratic Convention.
So I've got this routine, and it might be a rut that I've been in for a while where, you know, when I go to check my news in the morning, it's Twitter and it's the local news. And at some point I am going to bring up Salon, and I'm going to go to salon.com and bring up Salon. And without fail, the first story, I am going to see a giant Donald Trump looking just terrifying, horrific. And then there's going to be something about what was on late night TV the night before. And there's going to be another horrifying Trump story. And then there's going to be something about like women's issues and another horrifying Trump story. And I ran across an article by Robert Perry over at Consortium News about the danger of excessive Trump bashing. And I thought that this is something that I've been kind of wondering about after so many months and months and months of just, you know, writers and columnists and, you know, people that I really respect looking for bigger, deeper, and more broader ways to attack Donald Trump and to differentiate that candidate from Hillary Clinton, or, you know, the Trump movement from whatever we're going to call the Democratic movement going into the general elections. And Perry cites a couple of really interesting thoughts, and then there's another thought that I would bring in. And one of the things that he's very interested in his research and in his journalism is neoconservatism. And so what's happening through his lens is that the more we get to this place where it's just everything, all Trump is all bad, which it very well could be, you're also vacuuming up some of his criticism of the neoconservative, march to a new Cold War with Russia and new expanded military, adventures, shall we say, in the Middle East, and also some other details and and this and that, having to do with NATO, and you know, for all of the stuff that Trump, you should be terrified about Trump. About there are a few things that he says and then that he's put on the table that maybe we shouldn't be. Those aren't the things that we shouldn't go after him about. But this has gotten sucked up into the DNC email hack. And so the totally unproven conspiracy theory is that, oh, those DNC emails were supplied by Russian hackers because they want to see Donald Trump be president, because Donald Trump is now, the hyperbole is starting to grow, that he is somehow operating as an unwitting accomplice to Putin. There was a quote that I circled in one of these articles where an American intelligence official actually had a name for the way that he's looking at Trump's foreign policy stances. I was wondering if you had any other kind of take on that. Like, is there a point where bashing Trump is just too much, where we're going to go too far, and maybe people are going to maybe turn off to it?
Yeah, I mean, the mainstream of the Democratic Party, as they call themselves, mainstream, that's a self-selective term. They have used fear as a motivator to get people to vote for these corporate Democrats or these centrist Democrats for a long time. So right now it's the fear of Donald Trump. They have to keep driving that, right? They have to keep pushing that in order to motivate people whose inclinations are to the left, the people who are liberal people, to vote for to vote for Hillary Clinton, right? And to vote down the ticket for the other Democrats who might be running in such a fashion on that sort of kind of corporatist ticket. So fear of Trump, what Trump might do to the country. Now, I'll be perfectly honest with you. The people who are actually the Democrats are using it as a motivator to motivate their voters. The people who are actually scared of Donald Trump are the Republicans, because they're very scared that they'll lose control of their political party, or in the process of losing control of their political party to him. I think a lot of establishment Republicans are privately, some of them even publicly now, cheering on Hillary Clinton. They're the ones who are actually fearful of Donald Trump. I don't think the Democrats really are. They're just using it as a button to push to motivate the electorate. And yes, there is definitely the potential to overplay your hand in that situation, and they might well do that.
Well, and that was pointed out in this article too, where a lot of the if you read the New York Times and some of the neoconservative foreign policy voices in the New York Times and other policy vehicles on the national and international level, you've got neocons that have in the past, in the very recent past, clustered towards George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and that whole kind of crew, are now abandoning the Republicans and embracing Hillary Clinton.
Oh, there's no question about that. I mean, I don't think that. But look, Trump's foreign policy is a wild card. You know, he's buddying up with Putin. I think that there's some truth to that. I don't necessarily know that Putin is trying to buy the U.S. election or all of these sorts of conspiracy theories. He might be. Now look, I mean, I'm not a fan of the oligarchs in Russia or Vladimir Putin, but there seems to be this fear that Donald Trump may realign American foreign policy in a different way in terms of the relationship with Russia, in terms of the willingness to go and fight the sorts of battles in the Middle East that the neocons have advocated, and certainly the relationship with China, because the neoconservatives believe in open borders, well, not open borders as far as immigration, but free trade agreements, that sort of thing. And I think that there's a real fear of Trump on the trade issue, which, you know, I could see if I were on Wall Street or if I were in one of these neocon think tanks, I would be pretty concerned about a Trump presidency also, because you know, these guys can't, the bankers and the Wall Street types, they don't want a trade war with China. And if you're a neoconservative, you really don't want an alliance with Russia. That the pressure point with Russia that's been created now largely been created by Putin's own behavior, right? I'm not pretending this is something that has been created by the United States in its entirety. Although you could very, very, very openly state that the enlargement of NATO in the late 1990s was a provocative act under Bill Clinton, right? Adding Poland, at the time it was Poland, the Czech Republic, to NATO, but now everybody's been added to NATO, right? All the way to the Ukrainian border, all the way to the Russian border. They're all members of NATO. But that was a provocative act that began this cycle, and then obviously the war in Kosovo, a war I will admit, the neocons supported it. I will admit I supported that war. It was Tony Blair and Bill Clinton's war, but I felt that there was a humanitarian reason for going into Kosovo and protecting the Albanian Muslims that were being oppressed by Milosevic. Milosevic, of course, was a close ally of Russia. Serbia and Russia have always been aligned through history, as World War I reminds us. And but then that created, you know, this new pressure point between the neoconservatives and Putin came to power around that time in Russia in 1999. And there's been this pressure point since. There had been a attempt by Condoleezza Rice when she was the Secretary of State to effect some sort of rapprochement with Russia. But then Russia invaded Georgia with a few months left in the Bush administration. I think they invaded Russia in the middle of Georgia in the middle of the Republican convention in 2008, while Sarah Palin was being nominated and talking about seeing Russia out of her living room. But that that creates this pressure point, and now neocons need to have pressure points, right? There needs to be an us versus them mentality in the neocon thinking. And Trump threatens that if he is in alliance with Russian oligarchs or with Vladimir Putin. It's very much kind of a monolithic thing, at least in the mind of a neoconservative. So if you're a neoconservative leader, if you're Bill Kristol, the godfather of the movement, or his father, Irving Kristol, was, then you're – we know Kristol tried to recruit a third candidate in David France and was looking for other potential conservatives to run, you're probably privately supporting Hillary Clinton. Some in fact, are publicly supporting Hillary Clinton, right? Former Bush administration member officials on the foreign policy side. I have to Google and see what the latest list is, but they were beginning to come out of the woodwork because they're much more comfortable with her foreign policy.
Now, do you remember – This is where it all gets very interesting to me, because during the Obama administration, Russia actually played some vital roles with Obama in keeping foreign policy on the straight and narrow and really helping us out of a couple of awful situations. And one was in 2013 when, you know, tensions were boiling over in Syria. And there was the chemical weapons attacks, and it wasn't clear, the intelligence wasn't clear if these were truly weapons attacks that were coming from Assad or if they were provocations from the jihadists. And so Obama worked with Putin, like, under the table to defuse the situation, and while over the table he was still, you know, saying Putin's a terrible, awful guy who takes his shirt off too much and we can't trust him. But he actually, you know, it was actually, you know, Putin's foreign policy, you know, force that went and worked with Assad and defused that situation. And this is actually, you know, back in 2013 when it looked like everybody was asking Obama to go bomb Syria. And the progressive wing of the party, of the Democratic Party, was just saying, oh, no, not another war, not in Syria, we're not doing this. And one of the few voices, to plug my employer, one of the few voices who was out there who was very bravely saying this is not in our best interest was Alan Grayson. And it was one of the pieces. It was one of the pieces of his, you know, kind of rhetorical repertoire that really opened my eyes that he really wasn't just all about domestic policy. When you think about Alan Grayson, you think about somebody who is very attuned to kitchen table kinds of politics. You know, are you going to be able to send your kids to school? Is Social Security going to be there next week or when you retire or so on and so forth? But he's traveled to every country on the planet, and he's very attuned to foreign policy issues, which is one of the things that makes him such an excellent prospect for the Senate, where there's more truck with foreign policy. And then from the Syria thing, there was also, you know, Putin and Russia intervened in the Iran nuclear stockpile situation. So in convincing Iran to accept the tighter restraints on its nuclear program, where that was starting to fester and boil over and become a problem for us. And so reaching out to Russia and, you know, putting a lid on that was another way where this administration, the Obama administration, used diplomacy and negotiations in a way that I believe is a contrast, my own personal thing. I believe that is a contrast to what we are likely to see from Clinton 2.0 administration.
Brooke, I think this is very important that you make this distinction, because I've made this distinction over and over again with the Syria situation and the Iran situation. John Kerry was Secretary of State. John Kerry accomplished more in his first 9 months on the job as Secretary of State than Hillary Clinton had in 4 years. And I was saying it throughout 2013. My goodness, I mean, American diplomacy is back. I mean, we're using soft power to our advantage. We're doing the kinds of things that we should be doing. And so I think it's critical that people, when they think about the Obama administration and the foreign policy and these accomplishments, separate the first term when Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State from the second term when John Kerry was the Secretary of State. And the Iran deal is the crowning accomplishment. That's the crown jewel of John Kerry's diplomacy. That deal never would have been made by Hillary Clinton, even though she's now publicly supported it for political reasons, right? But she never would have made that deal. And Russia played a part in making that deal. And I think it's important. You look back at Syria, okay? There, with Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State and Robert Gates as Secretary of Defense, although Robert Gates went to Hillary Clinton, I can't remember which particular conflict it was. It was Libya or Syria, where he said to Clinton, "Hey, and obviously Gates was a holdover from the Bush administration, but he hadn't started either war, right? He'd come in after Rumsfeld had messed things up and was brought in by Bush. He's in the former CIA director, Elder Bush confidant, to try and put out the fires. And he told Secretary Clinton, "Let me finish the two wars I'm fighting before you start another war." As Secretary of Defense famously said this about the U.S. incursion in Libya, which was a very bad idea, and that was when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. In 2013, when there was this neocon rush for war on both sides of the Atlantic with Syria, on the British side, the Tories, Tory backbenchers were pushing David Cameron towards war. He then heard from the British people, and in very Cameron-esque fashion, because Cameron is this, you know, this very 50-50 guy that ended up getting walloped after the whole Brexit thing. He pulled the motion. They didn't even vote on it in Parliament. He heard from the British people. They didn't want another war. But his party was pushing, beating the war drums, as were so many in the U.S., based around this false notion that somehow arming the insurgents in Syria was a positive thing and would bring a pro-American regime. When, in fact, I think the evidence is it would not have. Now, let's think about this for a minute. The reason they wanted to arm the Syrian insurgents was because Assad is backed by Russia, and Assad's dad was an ally of the Soviet Union towards the end of the Cold War. Russia has its largest base outside of Russia in Syria, and Syria was also aligned with Iran. Now, It's tough to de-link all of this from the Israeli, Palestinian, and Mideast peace process, but I will say this. Had Assad been left alone, I think he probably would have made peace with Israel eventually. It was in his best interest. It was in the best interest of Syria. It was the best interest of the Ba'ath Party, which, by the way, is a secular party. The insurgents against Assad are all they're all Muslims. A lot of them are fundamentalists. The Ba'ath Party, and this is what's so ironic to me, because they beat the drums about Christianity, the neocons and the right-wingers in this country. Yet what they've done in Iraq is they've taken out a secular government with Christians in the government. You know, Tariq Aziz was a foreign minister for years for Saddam Hussein. He's a Christian. They've taken him out, and what you've got in its place is a religious fundamentalist government and mass chaos. That would have been the same thing that happened in Syria, where the Ba'ath Party, led by Bashar Assad, was led by his father Hafez al-Assad before, is a secular party. 90% of the Syrian Christians, or 95% of the Syrian Christians, back Assad to this day. But yet they wanted to take him out for geopolitical reasons. So they hide behind religion when they're in this country running for domestic policy. But in fact, they're very kind of almost in a way anti-Christian, right? When it gets to the Middle East, you know, they Christians are worse shape now in Iraq than they were before. They're worse shape in Libya now. Gaddafi had a secular government. Gaddafi was kind of into pan-Arabism as a concept, because there are Muslim Arabs and there are Christian Arabs. Anti-Americanism, obviously, he was into, but there were probably some reasons for that. And so Syria goes down into this this maniacal obsession with Iran and this anti-Russian thing to create the pressure points, and then the tacit alliance that the neocons have long had with Saudi Arabia over petroleum interests and other things, Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states, which, by the way, are some of the most oppressive regimes, biggest violators of human rights on this planet, are the countries that they've aligned with. Far greater violators of human rights than Iran. I'm not saying Iran is a great a secular country by any stretch of the imagination. Of course it's not. But I think if you're a woman, I mean, you're, it's bad in both places, but I think it's probably worse in Saudi Arabia. If you are a South Asian like me, it is worse in Saudi Arabia or Qatar than it is, far worse in those places, than it is in Syria or Iran. So there's a lot of racism in those places too. But these are the countries that the neocons have aligned themselves with. And so what, and then real quickly, I'll say one of the results of this is that there's now this growing kind of alliance of anti-American states that have all become aligned with Russia. So Russia, during the Cold War, had an ideological block of countries that, you know, left-wing countries, and there were socialist movements and left-wing revolutionary movements in Africa, anti-colonial movements in Africa and in Asia and in Latin America that aligned with the Soviet Union. Now what you have is this kind of weird mix of right-wing dictatorships and left-wing / socialist type countries that have now all aligned with Russia and Putin in an anti-American bloc. So you're talking about countries like Iran, which is a right-wing regime, Russia itself, which is a right-wing country at this point, and then a strong alliance with Maduro in Venezuela, who's a left-winger, the Castro brothers in Cuba, who's the left-wing state, North Korea, which is ideologically somewhere on the extreme, whether it's a right-wing state or a left-wing state, and all these kind of small, like, anti-American movements around the globe, with Putin as the focal point. So part of the strategy of the Saudis and the Americans has been to reduce the cost of oil so that both Venezuela and Russia and Iran, all three of those countries, get hurt in terms of their economic prowess. Because Saudi Arabia can ride out any downturn in petroleum prices. So
and let's underscore that, because that's the larger picture. That's the bird's eye view of the playing board. And I think it's very important to understand that the Bush administration had, and Cheney and George Bush, had Syria on their hit list at the very beginning of the Iraq War, you know, after 9/11 or whatever. And like you said, Assad was a reformist. And so there was a lot of pushback. There was enough pushback that they couldn't get the Joint Chiefs and enough people to sign on to attacking and going into Syria, because they were like, what the hell? It's a reformist regime. Why would you even do that? And so Bush in 2007 and way before started this whole rogue states thing, and, you know, beyond the axis of evil, and, you know, started working on this propaganda campaign to isolate Syria and to push Syria, you know, to the side so that Syria would become an acceptable target where it had not been before. It wasn't in 2003, but give them a few years and enough animus, you know, enough, you know, columnists in the New York Times, you know, taking up the banner, and Lord knows, you know, perhaps a Democratic candidate becomes president, and the neocons are going to get their invasion of Syria one way or another, it looks like.
Right, you know,
it ties into bringing down those to crushing the oil prices from Russia and from Venezuela. Sorry.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. So that I think that that's so important is that. So at this point, Syria is still being propped up by Russia. They're in alliance with Venezuela. There was this very unique alliance between Venezuela and Iran that had popped up, you know, this right-wing religious state and this left-wing socialist state in close alliance. Chavez and Ahmadinejad became best buddies, in fact, for a while, because it was just an anti-American alliance. They had to find, because there were all these pressure points being put on them by the U.S. and the Saudis, that they had to find some new alliances. You know, I find this kind of extremely ironic, because I think no country did more to fund the terrorism and the Palestinian Liberation Organization in Saudi Arabia during the 1960s and 1970s. Now, 1980s, you began to get Hezbollah and Hamas, these groups with Iranian backing, some groups with Libyan backing. And generally, there was a consensus among in the Muslim world, particularly in the Arab world, about the Israeli-Palestinian situation. But Saudi Arabia spent more money funding the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Now, there's no way you can escape this fact. There is a tacit alliance between Saudi Arabia and Israel, and there has been for many years on these matters. Even though Saudi Arabia still doesn't formally recognize Israel's right to exist. I'm not saying they obviously don't have diplomatic relations with it. They don't even recognize their right to exist. But there were back channel contacts between the two countries facilitated by the bloc of neoconservatives in the United States. You know, Jack Abramoff was pretty prominent in this before he went to jail in all of this back channel stuff between Israel and Saudi Arabia, the disgraced former Greenberg Traurig lobbyist. If you want a quick primer on him, I guess watch the movie Casino Jack, right, with Kevin Spacey playing Jack Abramoff. There's a lot more to the Abramoff story than just that movie, but that's a quick primer. You can probably find it on Amazon Prime or on Netflix. But there were all these back-channel contacts because the Saudis have decided they want to take Iran out, and Israel, of course, wants to take Iran out also. And then they want Assad gone in Syria. And then there's this nexus of American influence. And there's always been these sort of back-channel contacts involving the United States and Israel. Because if you remember the Iran-Contra affair, the U.S. shipped a lot of the weapons that were shipped to Iran were shipped via Israel. Israel and Iran had actually had a pretty close relationship when the Shah had been in power. They were the first Muslim state to recognize Israel's right to exist and then diplomatically recognize them a year or two later. But there had always been these back channels between Iran and Israel. And then once the kind of pivot took place and Iran became a Iran was an anti-Soviet state. I think this – I'm just going to take a step back. I know this is a lot for our listeners to digest. But Iran was not particularly closely aligned with the Soviet Union in the 1980s. Obviously, they were a religious state, a right-wing state. Ideologically, they would have no commonalities with the Soviet Union. And they had been there was obviously a horrible relationship with the United States, but there was this kind of feeling that they were – still a buffer state, right, against Soviet expansionism to a certain extent. I think then with the Taliban in Afghanistan, this is why Iran is so irked by the shift in U.S. policy. The Northern Alliance that was fighting the Taliban at the time of 9/11, the insurgents were being funded and armed by Iran. And then Iran turned around after 9/11. Obviously, they have no diplomatic relationship with the United States, but they turned around and said to the Bush administration, hey, you know, we'll help you with intelligence. We'll help you because we want to get rid of these Taliban guys as badly as you do now. We have a common enemy. So Iran helped with a lot of the intelligence that gave the U.S. a quick victory and put Karzai in power by the end of 2001. Then – the very next month, George Bush gives this Axis of Evil speech, State of the Union, where he throws Iran in. David Frum has now admitted this. David Frum is one of the few conservatives I like. I mean, I don't like him ideologically, but I really respect him. He's a great speechwriter, great thinker. He's admitted that they just needed a third country. I mean, they had Iraq and North Korea, and they were batting around. Do we put Cuba in? Do we put Syria in? Do we put Venezuela in? Who do we put in? They decided on Iran kind of arbitrarily without any logic. So they throw Iran in as the third country in the Axis of Evil speech, and all hell breaks loose. I mean, basically, that one moment just was the tipping point that created all of this trouble and drove Iran towards Russia, towards Putin, and then allowed Ahmadinejad to be a reformer in Rafsanjani in the next presidential election. Then Iran took this – they'd already pivoted towards Russia – they then took a real hard line, became aligned with Cuba and Venezuela, and we're still in this kind of ridiculous Cold War until the Kerry Obama deal, which I think was a landmark in American diplomacy. But we basically spent 12 years fighting the Iranians when we didn't need to, and now we still have a lot of domestic political leaders led by the neoconservatives who want to undo that Iran deal, and you and I see it every day, Brooklyn, where there's discussions about foreign policy and discussions of things going on in Democratic primaries and Republican primaries. The Iran deal is at the top of the list. So we're still paying for that rather arbitrary decision by the Bush administration to put Iran in the Axis of Evil at a time when Iran had helped us win the war, or at least win that first phase of the war in Afghanistan.
And so bringing the back around to party politics, like how much of a crazy coup is it going to be? Which crazy coup, by the way, is going to be the name of my new banjo band that's going to be all women, crazy coup. How much of a coup is it going to be for, you know, should Hillary Clinton win the White House to go into the White House with a mandate to, you know, bring ground troops into Syria? Because, you know, for the next, you know, however many days until the general election, we're going to, you know, fight this rhetorical war against Donald Trump on, you know, how anti-Russia we are, you know, using Syria and using the Middle East as the fulcrum there, you know? And so what I see happening, and it's been happening ever since all of the stuff in Ukraine and Crimea, is as soon as liberals start, you know, casting a hairy eyeball and going, hey, wait a minute, I don't know if that's exactly what I'm supporting here. As soon as as soon as progressives start asking those questions, they get smeared by centrists and moderates and, you know, third wayers as, you know, oh, you're just, you know, Russia lovers and Putin huggers and this, that, and the other. And so what seems to me to be happening is that we're going to come out of this election, if Hillary Clinton is elected, with a mandate to start a whole new war in Syria, which is a war that we rejected as Democrats under Obama. And it seems very ironic to me.
Yeah, it's very ironic. And the need to go and engage in Syria is still just a ridiculous notion. I mean, this has been the calling card of Kelly Ayotte and John McCain and Lindsey Graham, that pack of neocons in the U.S. Senate, that somehow, even when President Obama has towed their line 75%, somehow we have to go that full 100% and go to war in these places. I think it'll be fascinating to see how Hillary Clinton pivots on ISIS slash ISIL slash Daesh, whatever term you prefer to describe them, because my guess is that she's going to talk very tough about them and rhetorically in a way that President Obama has not. Now, President Obama called them the JV team. Maybe I'm in the extreme minority here, but I agree with that characterization. I mean, these are guys, this is not an organized terrorist group like al-Qaeda. This is not a group that's an actual state actor, as they, even though they call themselves Islamic State. They're not, okay? They're just a bunch of kind of rogue elements that have certain chunks of territory outside of major cities in Syria and Iraq, and have a great social media presence, have a great social media team that has engaged these disparate followers all over the globe who go kind of conduct lone wolf attacks on places and then claim they're doing it in allegiance with the Islamics. That's what they are. And I know that's a very unpopular view, since there are people even in our party, in the Democratic Party, who say, oh, they could deliver a nuclear warhead to Los Angeles or something, which is just, you know, I can't believe some of the things I've heard from fellow Democrats, fellow people who claim to be liberals. But so I think Hillary Clinton will probably take a harder line rhetorically than Obama did. I think when Obama called them the JV team, I think he was spot on, and I wish people understood what he had meant, which is these are just a bunch of kind of crazy lone wolf, you know, dropouts from society, basically. The people they've attracted in the West have been attracted by their social media presence and have some sort of grievance against the Belgian society or American society or British society or whatever it is. So
and I'm
I am
so glad you,
because I think she's going to take a harder line on this.
And I am so glad that you took the discussion there, because – you know, when we started talking about this, we started the way I set it up was, is there a danger of excessive Trump bashing, going back to the Robert Perry piece from Consortium News? And there was another piece that I came across this week from ProPublica, and it's called White Trash, the Original Underclass. And I think, you know, if we cast our gaze from international and foreign policy to what's going on domestically, and you look at the way that domestically we're starting to talk about Trump and Trump's followers and what's so bad about Trump, like why does Trump suck and why do we hate Trump and why do we hate Trump's followers, and there's, it's 100% legitimate. If you walk into a Trump a rally, it's terrifying. It's not the place you want to be as, you know, as a rational person. But I'm afraid, and in this article that was published this week in ProPublica, talks about, it's really long and it's really in depth and it's fascinating. It talks about two books that have just been released, and one is called, and I've been waiting for this one to come out, White Trash, the 400-Year Untold Story of Class in America, which is a, you know, kind of a barn burner nonfiction piece. And then there's another one that's you know, more of a soft kind of personal history thing. But as we focus this animus on Donald Trump, the candidate, are we also creating animus against a class of people that we're imagining? Are we creating a new ugly identity politics where we're imagining poor white people as people who are undeserving of any kind of sympathy? And, you know, I was reminded, and it's in this article, Kevin Williamson of the National Review wrote in March, I mean, he's a provocateur and all, but he wrote in March in an article that was just heaping scorn on Trump and Trump's followers. He was talking about, you know, how all of the white trash and the people who follow Trump, they're all having babies out of wedlock and they're all drug addicts and they all deserve what they get because all of the industries that used to employ them, well, they just aren't what they used to be. And, quote, there is more to life in the 21st century than wallboard and cheap sentimentality about how the man closed the factories down. And he goes on to say that economically these people are negative assets and morally they are indefensible. Forget all your cheap theatrical Bruce Springsteen crap. Forget your sanctimony about the struggling Rust Belt factory towns and your conspiracy theories about the wily Oriental stealing your jobs. And here's the best part. He says, the white American underclass is enthralled to a vicious, selfish culture whose main products are misery and used heroin needles. Donald Trump's speeches make them feel good, and so does OxyContin. I come away with that just sickened. It's hilarious, but it's also sickening because we've already, I mean, if you participate in any kind of, you know, online dialogue with, you know, people across the country, I'm sure you already have experienced quite a bit of identity-based bashing of people from the South, you know, rednecks, blah, 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 this and that. And what's so cool is that these books are coming out and this, you know, 400-year untold history of class in America is fascinating because it gives you insight into what's going on, particularly in one of my favorite states in the whole nation, North Carolina. North Carolina is so cool and messed up because North Carolina was where if you were too poor to be in Virginia, you went to North Carolina, right? And it is totally reflected in the culture now. That's why you've got these extreme, you know, conservative wackos rubbing shoulders and right next to some of the most incredible writers and thinkers and people doing science just right next door to each other. North Carolina has some of the most vibrant culture that you're going to find in all of the South, if not, you know, this side of the Mississippi. It is an amazing part of the country. And part of that is because of, you know, how it was founded. It was founded by extremely poor people who were pushed out of other places. And so as we're on our way to being horrified about Donald Trump, are we also creating this tribal animus against poor white people as well?
Yeah, I think we are. I've spoken out on this earlier, previously this election season and in 2014 also. Part of being liberal for me is being very tolerant and open-minded and accepting. And I feel like some of our brethren on the left have become exceedingly judgmental and have taken judgment to a whole new level when it comes to poor white, particularly in Appalachia. So you talk about North Carolina and in places like North Carolina, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, those places, I think it's particularly unfortunate to see how a lot of Democrats and liberals have reacted to people in those places. And maybe that's why we're not winning elections in those places anymore. Maybe that's why we've gone from Jimmy Carter carried six states in 1980. One of them was West Virginia. Michael Dukakis carried 10 states in 1988. One of them was West Virginia. Now West Virginia, the spread in West Virginia is as wide as it is in favor of the Republicans in presidential elections, as wide as it is in places like Utah. Well, maybe not Utah and Idaho. Those are extreme examples, but certainly Montana, Kansas, those sorts of Nebraska, those sorts of very Republican states that the Democrats have never been competitive in since the 64 election, are places that now have the same spread in presidential elections as West Virginia, a state, I repeat, that Michael Dukakis won in 1988, a state that Jimmy Carter won in 1980, two very low watermarks. It was actually one of George McGovern's best states in 1972 also, in spite of obviously he didn't win, he only won one state, but it was a state where Democrats did well, even at the national level, and now that's very telling as to what's happened. Now you could say it's gun issues or environmental issues. Maybe there's some truth to that, but I think there's also an attitudinal shift among people on the left and rhetorically on the left that has lost places like West Virginia for us for not only a generation but perhaps longer.
Well, West Virginia was also one of the states that Bernie Sanders led in by 20 plus points and was, finished up the primary there incredibly ahead of Hillary Clinton. And it was one of those things that if you haven't spent time in Appalachia and you're not familiar with the politics of economics up there, you were just sort of like, what? How'd that happen? But the history is rich, and it has to do with TVA, and it has to do with the textile mills coming and going, and it has to do right now with mountaintop removal and environmental crises, and it has to do with how people are being displaced and screwed over. And when you got somebody who's coming along saying in a credible manner that we're going to fix this, we're going to do this together, you've got in places like Tennessee and in West Virginia and in North Carolina and in like Southwest Virginia, you've got people who are like, sign me up. I will work on that. You know, like Tennessee is a volunteer state, and the whole Appalachian region, you know, when people went to war, you know, like it was a volunteer state because people volunteered to go to the front lines of war. And, you know, part of what, when I was in college up in Appalachia, I worked in folklore for a while. I was really good friends with the folklorist at the university, Richard Blaustein. And you found that these Appalachian folks were, they wanted to be at the front of the war. They wanted to be, you know, the guys who were showing the way, and they were the ones who were getting shot first. So they're also ready to be at the front lines of getting these people elected and making change. So I just got a heads up from the lovely British lady from Blog Talk Radio that we have 60 seconds left. Is there anything you want to add for this week, Kartik?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. I mean, I enjoyed the discussion, especially on the neocon issue and this contempt that some liberals have developed for white working class voters.
Me too. So I'm gonna leave it there, and to take us out, I'm going to leave us all with Southern Culture on the Skids, a great band from North Carolina doing the song that usually brings me in, and next week I think we're going to do the same thing again, only a little bit longer, and we'll talk to you guys then. Bye.